You are now about to witness the strength of street knowledge.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. That's Straight Outta Compton by N.W.A. On this day in 1989, this song hit the Billboard charts. And we're about to hear my interview with Lawrence Hill, author of The Book of Negroes, that was made into a miniseries on BET. You can see, meet, and hear Lawrence Hill tonight at the Enoch Pratt Free Library at the Central Branch in the Wheeler Auditorium at 7 p.m. More information, please go to PrattLibrary.org. And we're joined here now by Lawrence Hill. Lawrence, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Mark. Great to be here.
And let me just say before we start, we'll tell you at the end that you can meet Lawrence Hill and talk to him about this book and more on April the 1st, this April the 1st at 7 p.m. at the Enoch Pratt Central Branch downtown. And get there early because I know there'll be lots of folks coming, especially since the miniseries has aired and people are dying to kind of have this conversation. So, Lawrence, let's take a step backwards here. So, you grew up, for the most part, in Canada, but your parents were Americans, right?
Yes, I grew up with a sort of a foot in both countries family-wise because my parents, African-American father, white American mother, married in D.C. in 1953 and fled the States the day after they married and never went back. So they moved to Canada 24 hours after marrying, and and so they raised their family, you know, in Canada, but we kept a in tight connection with my father's family, especially, and would often visit, you know, the black side of the family in D.C. and Brooklyn and North Carolina when I was growing up.
So and the book itself, just for our listeners who have not either read it nor seen the miniseries, the book itself, the Book of Negroes, is something that's really fascinating because you're telling a history that most people have only heard about because of the Underground Railroad, and that's the connection people have with Africans in Canada. But this is a different story. This is a story about the history that combines America and black men and women who stood up for their own freedom to go with the British to end up in Canada. So that this is a different tale than most Americans are used to.
Yes, most Americans, and frankly, most Canadians know next to nothing about African-Canadian history.
I'm sure that's true.
And its connections to African-American history. And the Canadians are willfully and happily kind of ignorant of our own history and are happy to point an accusatory finger at the history of slavery in the States without knowing that the same history unfolded, not the same history, but a similar history unfolded in Canada simultaneously. So the story of the Black Loyalists is a story that's really unknown to most North Americans, let's say, and it's the story of those who lost in the American Revolutionary War, and that involved the story of thousands of African Americans who served on the losing side of that war, and then, of course, had to flee the United States after the rebels won and the Tories lost.
And this particular story, though, the Book of Negroes, the title I know we'll talk about in a moment because the controversy in America around the title, but this is an actual document, and you're building this around, this is historical fiction, but it's built around fact. It's built around a real book that took place.
Yes. The Book of Negroes is a novel in the name of a miniseries, and it's also the name of a British military ledger, 150-page ledger, which I've touched and read and seen. You can see it in the New York Public Library and in the National Archives in D.C. as well as in other places. Hmm. But you can also see it online. But the Book of Negroes was kept by the British Navy in 1783 to record the flight, the exodus of 3,000 African-Americans who were fleeing Manhattan at the end of the Revolutionary War and going to Nova Scotia on the Atlantic coast of Canada before they can be recaptured by their former owners, the people they served against during the war. So they're fleeing Manhattan and going to Canada after serving the British on the losing side of the American Revolutionary War. And their names are entered into this British naval ledger called the Book of Negroes, which is really the first time in the history of the States or Canada that thousands of black people are publicly documented by a formal body, this body being the British Navy.
And the book itself, I mean, the story that you wrote, The Book of Negroes, built around this woman, Aminata Diallo, whose name was changed and saved to Tamina, Tamina D. She's a fascinating character. I mean,
she is.
And you made this connection on purpose, this deep connection to her African roots and her Muslim roots.
Yes, I did. Well, I feel that the not just I feel, I know that the first form of literature widely published and disseminated by peoples in the African diaspora is a slave narrative. This is who I am. These are who my parents were. This is how I came to lose my freedom. This is the name of my owner. This is how I came to be free. This is my story, dear reader, and I'm going to put it down on this page so I have to assert that I am equal to you in my humanity. So the slave narrative, the autobiography of the ex-slave, is the first form of literature widely published by blacks in the States and Canada and in England as well and in the Caribbean. And so this novel, The Book of Negroes, acts as if it's a slave narrative. It's not a slave narrative. It's my own novel. It's a work of fiction, but it functions in the literary tradition of the slave narrative, and it stands on the shoulders of the slave narrative. And so the person who tells her life story, which becomes this novel, The Book of Negroes, is Aminata Diallo, an African woman who's brought into slavery in the States, and then her life unfolds in a very dramatic way.
And it's, she's a brilliant woman, and she's a well-read woman, and a woman who is multilingual, and the power she has in the face of her alleged masters, the people who physically owned her body. I mean, you created this character for a special reason to be this powerful.
Yes, I wanted her to be powerful. I wanted her to be a survivor. And I mean, already it's a miracle that people could physically survive the Middle Passage and land in America and not die en route or not die when they landed, expire of exhaustion and torture, but and malnourishment and the rest, but infection. But in addition to the physical miracle of survival is the emotional elasticity, the emotional resilience of millions of African peoples who not only survived physically but had to carry on emotionally and carry on with their lives, loving, living, having children, doing what they had to do to carry on. And so I tried to give a face to the life of a woman caught up in this migration. And I think one of the great tragedies of slavery is that it tends to, in thinking about it and using the word, and is that it tends to put a mask down over the face of people who are so-called slaves. And when we say the word slave, we often don't see a face, we don't see hands, we don't imagine a real person, we just imagine the person in chains. And I wanted to shatter those chains and show the life of a strong woman who's surviving emotionally and physically as she moves in and out of slavery and regains her freedom, you know, before she's too old.
And also the people around her that you created in this novel are people who are supportive and gentle. For the most part, I'm talking about people who have African. For the most part, the people of African descent,
Yes, and some of them fall apart. I mean,
right,
she's
right.
A character who survives; others didn't. I mean, she's stolen into slavery as a child, just entering adolescence, just entering puberty, and some of the people around her fall apart. You know, lose the capacity to speech. You know, or become murderous or suicidal. Understandable impulses given the gravity of the changes forced upon them. But Aminata somehow has the emotional elasticity of a child to hold it together and not to become an utterly hateful, bitter, murderous, you know, or suicidal person. She wants to go on living and to be a storyteller and to tell the world what's happened to her and to make her life count for something in the telling.
So I'm curious, when you began the research for this book, and I know you must have done mounds and mounds of reading and scouring old books and reading narratives, which I want to hear about, but was there a person named Aminata Diallo in that Book of Negroes?
No,
I
made
not.
Her up.
Okay. I wasn't sure if there was somebody's name you ran across and went, let me make a person, let me tell this story or build a story around this name. But
no, Aminata is the name of the middle name of my eldest daughter. I have five children.
Oh, wow.
She's also the name of a midwife that I met when I was working as a volunteer in the West African nation of Mali. Of course, Aminata is a very common name in Muslim West Africa, just as common as Mary or Joanne is, say, in the United States. Aminata is a very common name, a beautiful name. And so you meet, you know, if you travel or live in any Muslim country in West Africa, you're bound to meet many people whose name is Aminata or Amina.
And Diallo is a common name as well.
Yes, it is. Absolutely. Yeah.
So this book of the struggle of this kind of the for her freedom and ending up in Canada because of the Book of Negroes and going to Nova Scotia and then the entire history of that and Sierra Leone and back to England. There's also to me kind of this connection that you seem to make in subtext to me throughout the book, which just has to do with the connections between the African diaspora and the continent itself.
Yes. Well, I think the connection, I think we make a mistake of somehow imagining the world in distinct silos. And we like to think, because it's convenient, that the African-American experience is distinct from the African-Canadian experience, which is distinct from the Jamaican experience and distinct from the experience of African people on the continent of Africa. But actually, of course, especially if you're looking at the 18th century with this kind of constant migration of people back and forth across the Atlantic Ocean, we have a history that's united by migration. So you have people who are moving around the world as if they're forming some sort of intercontinental milk run, you know, from place to place to place. That's the story of the Black Loyalists. And so, yes, there are things that make the African-American experience distinct from that in Canada and in the UK and in Africa and the Caribbean. But there are many other things that unite those experiences. And one of the things that unites them is migration. And, of course, many of us have families, you know, if we look back far enough, all over the world. I do. You know, American and Canadian and ultimately African and European, and many others do too. So I was looking to sort of unite those experiences by telling a story that's truly transatlantic in its scope and not purely just American or Canadian.
No, I think that you said something interesting earlier. That there's many things, but I mean, and your book is fantastic, and some of the essays I've been reading you wrote are just, I think, very, very cogent and probing. But you said that even the Canadians are, I think you used the words, willfully ignorant.
Yes.
Of the Black history of Canada.
Yes, we are.
And so that's interesting to me. And I wonder, as a person who's had his life, spent time on the continent itself, parents who were American spent time here in the States but grew up in Canada, what is different about the African diaspora experience growing up in Canada than somebody who might have grown up in the United States?
Well, there are many differences. One of them, of course, it's a complicated question, and
yeah.
It's no less complicated than if somebody were to ask, what's the difference between white Americans and white Canadians? Well, you sort of have to take in a breath and begin a long story. So it's not easy to
summarize those
differences, because, of course, peoples are complex and their histories are complex. The one difference is that slavery existed in Canada as well. It ended about 30 years before it drew to an end in the United States. But it never had the economic kind of leverage that it did in the United States, simply because we didn't have the weather that allowed for plantation economies. We didn't have rice or cotton, you know, or indigo, you know, to grow, you know, in huge quantities and to export around the world. We didn't have plantation economies because we didn't have that kind of weather system or climate. So slavery never became a massive rural agricultural phenomenon. It was an urban phenomenon in Canada. Most slaves in Canada were held in cities and worked as urban slaves. And also, of course, the numbers were much less. Canada's population, of course, is just a fraction of America's population, but the percentage of slaves in Canada was infinitely smaller as a percentage than it was in the United States. So economically, demographically, the picture was never as vivid or as large, you know, in Canada as it was in the States, but it was still there, and it was still enshrined in the economies and the actions and the laws of our country. So it was there, but many Canadians, perhaps because it didn't dominate the economy the way it did in the United States, have conveniently forgotten it and would much prefer to talk about American slavery, you know, which is somehow morally satisfying than to acknowledge that the same problems, the same sin against humanity, you know, basically was perpetuated in Canada too for the same length of time. Slavery, the first documented slave in Canada dates back to 1628. In Quebec City, a young boy from Madagascar, whose name is Olivier Lejeune.
Madagascar? Wow.
That's unusual, I know.
Yeah.
Of course, we know that most slaves who came into the Americas were coming from West Africa. I understand that. But in this case, by some circuitous route that I can't fully explain, this boy came from Madagascar. At any rate, 1628 is the first documented slave encounter. There were probably others earlier, but we don't have the documentation about them. And that's about as early as slavery is beginning in the States. So our history goes back just as far as yours does in the States in terms of slavery, but it just happens to end 30 or so years earlier.
So I wonder how – it's interesting that, that the Canadian Broadcasting System did this with Black Entertainment Television when they turned your book into this miniseries, which I want to ask you directly about. But I'm just curious, did was this shown on CBC?
Oh, yes. It was a huge hit. It was the most watched television series in Canada for the last 25 years.
Really? Really?
It was a massive hit in Canada, I have to say. I realize that might sound immodest, but it was a...
No, not at all. It's reality.
Well, it was a huge hit on TV, and it was a major bestseller as a novel in Canada.
Yeah, you sold some 700,000 copies in Canada or more?
Yeah,
is that right?
about 800,000, yes.
That's amazing. That's phenomenal. I mean, it's a great book. It's such a well-written book, and I really actually enjoyed the TV series as well, which I wasn't sure I was going to because they often can butcher a book.
Yeah, well, it's hard. I co-wrote it, and it was a complex... It's a big job to take a 500-page novel and convert it into basically 6 times 45 minutes is the time you have on the screen. It's about 44 minutes times 6. So it's hard. So you have to make a lot of decisions, and you have to be boiled down, and television is television, so you have to work within that medium. But given the limitations and the realities of the medium, I felt quite happy with it, and it was a thrill to write, and I learned a lot as a writer just to write my first, co-write my first major screenplay.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of fun. And I, of course, got to go to the film sets in South Africa and in Canada and hang out with the actors and spend a lot of time with the director who co-wrote with me. It was really an exciting project. And interestingly, it gave employment to thousands of people, including many Black actors. And it's hard for Black actors to get good work in interesting roles where people are real and human and have dimensionality.
Yes.
And they're not sort of just given stereotypical roles. So I was actually quite proud that the miniseries generated interesting employment for, among others, all sorts of, African-American and African-Canadian and African actors.
No, it did. And I was very – the whole thing was so well done, well acted. I was – please, but what I was so upset about was that in America, unlike Canada then, that this wonderful TV series based on this incredible novel of yours was seen on BET, and which limited the audience, which I thought... Well, I love BET for doing it. I thought it was a beautiful thing to do, but I just wish it had a wider audience here.
Well, we always wish for a wider audience, but it's still attracted something like 8 million viewers, which is not bad.
No, that's not bad. No.
It's not like a hit in terms of popular American television, but it's a respectable 8 million viewers. And sure, I can understand that, but at least you could say BET had the guts to do it and other television network was interested. BET came forward. And at least they came forward. Without BET, there wouldn't have been a Book of Negroes miniseries in the States. And so we could lament that, or we could say, well, at least they had the chutzpah, if I can say that.
You can't say that.
to stand up and do it. And also to call it the Book of Negroes, which was an act of courage.
Yes, because tell that story, because you had difficulties in America with that title, which you did not have in Canada.
Yes, I did have difficulties. Well, of course, the word Negroes is such a contentious and difficult word, and it has such an interesting history. I mean, my father was an African-American, born in Independence, Missouri in 1923. So he was a soldier in the U.S. Army in the Second World War, and right through the 60s and 70s, he proudly called himself a Negro because, let's face it, most middle-class African-Americans in the 60s and 70s were calling themselves Negroes until... the term sort of fell out of fashion and was replaced by Black and African-American, and the Black Power movement sort of gave another sense of pride to the use of the word Black. So the word's undergone a lot of change over the decades, and now, of course, it's considered a kind of derogatory word, but it wasn't, 50 or 60 years ago. And so I didn't use the word Negroes in the title to provoke or upset anybody. I just used it to resurrect this long-forgotten document called the Book of Negroes, kept by the British Navy, which feeds into the story centrally. In Canada, the title seemed to fly. People seemed to be accepting of it. In the States, My publisher required me to change the title because they worried that booksellers wouldn't stock it, you know, with the word Negroes in the title, and worried about offending African Americans. So the title changed in the States to Someone Knows My Name, to my frustration. However, now that the miniseries is out, called The Book of Negroes by Black Entertainment Television,
right,
thankfully, the publisher felt it was okay to fall in step. And if BET can use the word Negroes, so can the publisher. So they reissued the novel in January. So now it's available in the States as The Book of Negroes, published by W.W. Norton and Company.
Now, it really is an adventurous tale, and you follow her and wondering how this is going to end up. Because I obviously read the book before I saw the miniseries, and you didn't, you know, what was going to be the end? How was she going to get out of the United States and into Canada? What happened to her in Nova Scotia? How was she going to get from there to where she wanted to be and find her village? I mean, it was such a thoughtful book, and also you recreated that world in ways that made us feel we were in it.
Thank you. Well, one of the things you have to do as a novelist is sort of ask yourself, at the outset of a story, what does my character want? And the one word that I kept putting in her head as I tried to imagine Aminata Diallo is the idea, I want to go home.
Mm-hmm.
I've been ripped from my homeland, but I want to go home. And she's 11 when she's stolen from Africa and taken into what is then called the province of South Carolina, because it's still a British colony. And this is around 1775 or so that she arrives in South Carolina. And she wants to go home, and that sort of motivates everything she does. And she's stolen from her continent at 11, so she's old enough to remember who she is, but young enough to have this naive dream of returning home one day. And who knew beforehand that among all the millions of people who are stolen and kidnapped into slavery in the States, a number of them, 1,200, got back to Africa and actually managed to get back to Africa in the same lifetime in which they were stolen. It's an unheard of story.
Never heard of that. So, no one's ever written about that. Not that I've seen, anyway.
I've never read anything about this in the way of fiction before. And so I was delighted to come across this in a kind of an obscure but accurate, you know, academic history book. And then to base my novel on this idea of African peoples who are brought into the Americas, go over to Canada after serving the British on the losing side of the Revolutionary War, and then get back to Africa before they die.
So, but before we have to let you go, we have to take a couple of journeys at least, and one of those journeys is you have this deep connection to Baltimore, both familially and in terms of your own life.
I do. Well, my great-grandfather, Daniel Hill, and grandfather, who had the same name, and father had all lived and been connected to Baltimore, and my great-grandfather was the minister in the Bethel AME Church on Druid Hill Avenue. And then when I came to study at Hopkins to do my graduate work there, although I'm not an active church person or a deep believer myself, I certainly respect the Black Church, and it's part of my own family history. So I started going to the Bethel AME Church just to get to know some of my family who are still in Baltimore. And then I wrote a novel that was actually partly set in Baltimore and in the Black Church there, called In Unknown Blood, that came out some years ago. But so yes, I have a family and a personal connection to the city.
And your master's degree in writing from Johns Hopkins, and you did a little bit of teaching. And so, how long did you live here?
Yes, I did. Just a year. Yeah, it was a quick MA, 1 year, 1992 to 93. But I've been back, you know, a few times, and love the city. And coming back, of course, to give a talk at Enoch Pratt Library
April the first,
and still have friends, you know, among the staff, you know, at Hopkins, and keep in touch with them.
That's good. I'm glad that connection is there. And I want to let our listeners know how the connection runs and these kind of odd synchronicities that exist in our lives. And in this the book itself. I think looking at some of the other work that you've been working on and the things you've been writing, I mean, there is this connection, this disconnect in some ways, this in some ways this book connects between Africans and Africa, between African diasporic people and Africa, I should say.
Well, I have this connection. I mean, one of the reasons I have this connection is that, well, although I have, you know, I'm of African-American origin and, you know, identify as Black and grew up in an ultimately almost entirely white suburb of Toronto in the 1960s. So I was hungry to sort of get to know my own ancestry in Hungary to reach out and to kind of make connections in the black community outside of my own family. And unlike a place like Baltimore, where you can sort of reach out and touch black communities, you know, there was no geographically distinct black community, you know, in Toronto when I was growing up there in the 1960s. So I had to sort of find my community. And one of the ways I found it was to become a writer and a reader. But another way that I found it, you know, was to just connect with family, like in the States. But a third way was to start traveling to Africa, to start working in Africa, you know, as a volunteer with a nonprofit, you know, charitable group called Crossroads International. So I started traveling as a young man to work as a volunteer in Mali and in Cameroon and Niger, and been back recently to Swaziland. And so these travels as a volunteer, not as a tourist, sort of allowed me to forge, you know, new and deeper connections and sort of embarked me on a lifelong path of wondering, well, what is it that connects and that disconnects African Americans from Africa? And how is it that on one hand, we all come from the same place, and on the other hand, there's such a huge, you know, such a huge set of waters between us, and often worlds that don't intersect at all. And it led me to meditate on this in an essay about this very issue.
Well, I just want to say, Lawrence Hill, this is the book is so exciting and such a powerful read. And
thank you.
I mean that. I don't do interviews with authors unless I like the book. So
thank you. Well, I'd love to have a chance to meet you one day and to come to Baltimore and again, and of course, you know, meet the people of Baltimore, and I'll speak about the book and the miniseries on April 1st. But hopefully, there will be other visits in addition.
So you do not want to miss this conversation with Lawrence Hill on April 1st at 7 p.m. at the Central Branch, the Enoch Pratt Library. You know, all those places can fill up. Get there around 6:30, relax, talk to people, get a seat. If you have a chance beforehand, pick up the Book of Negroes by Lawrence Hill and just read it so you can help with this conversation. Or you can also go on and see the miniseries, which is online other places as well, which is well worth the watch. Really well done. Some people want to compare it to Roots, but it's much deeper and more powerful than all that, I think, because it's been done in a more modern era, which is why I think it's a better film. But all that said, Lawrence Hill, thank you so much for being here with us on the Mark Steiner Show.
Thank you so much, Mike. I hope to meet you sometime soon.
We will. Thank you.
Okay, take care.
You too. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern and Dan History research producer is Sienna Greaves. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To podcast The Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And on our way out of here, we're hearing That's What's Going On by Marvin Gaye, who passed away on this day in 1984. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.